Hello and welcome to Lee Strickland's Focus on Business. I'm your host, Lee Strickland. On today's program, I am honored to have a guest with me via telephone from Arizona, Nick Dernias. He is the president and executive director within the Office of the President of Compact for America, Educational Foundation Incorporated. And we're talking today about a balanced budget amendment for the federal government and the process that we take for each state to support that. North Carolina right now has the bill HB 366 in front of the Judiciary Committee, and it just came out of that committee last Wednesday and will be going to the legislature for voting and processing. And the Compact for America initiative is using a formal interstate agreement to advance one or more constitutional amendments. And in particular, we're talking about the balanced budget amendment. And Nick's going to give us the insights about how this works and his previous background. So he's been general counsel and constitutional policy director for the Goldwater Institute, where he held the Clarence J. and Catherine P. Duncan Chair and directed the Joseph and Dorothy Donnelly Moeller Center. And Nick's challenge right now is to help us as the citizens of the United States navigate the process to a balanced budget amendment. Nick, thanks for being on the show today.
It's my pleasure. And you're right, North Carolina is leading right now with HB 366. The good news is it was now referred to appropriations, so we're going to beat the crossover deadline, which means if it hadn't been sent over to a new committee, the bill would have been dead on April 30th because it had not yet gotten to the floor. But now that it's assigned to a new committee, that means the bill can be heard for months. And so we can continue to educate North Carolinians, get them excited about the Compact for a Balanced Budget. And one of the things that's exciting about it is we can, in principle, get to a federal balanced budget amendment in as few as 12 months if we just have enough states like North Carolina leading the charge.
So kind of explain, I think we all remember from our civics courses and stuff, the process of taking a bill through the governmental process, but why do we want to take this approach? Why are we not waiting on Congress to do this? And just how do we go through a process state by state to get an amendment made to the Constitution, and in this case, the balanced budget amendment?
Well, we don't want to wait on Congress because we have been waiting on Congress, and Congress has been doing nothing but adding to the national debt in exponential rates. I mean, it's literally going to infinity and beyond. And what's wrong about that is it's obviously unsustainable. At some point, our creditors, the people lending us this money, are going to pull the plug. And when that plug is pulled, you know, and interest rates go to historical, even 1970s levels, it will be pandemonium. It will be a fiscal calamity that's just like what we're seeing in Greece and in Southern Europe. And as you look out at Baltimore, you know that our country is not strong enough to handle the kind of whirlwind that could result with, you know, cutting spending and raising taxes, you know, 20, 30, 40%. So, you know, the reason why this matters is we've got to get a handle on the budget. We've got to stop borrowing at an exponential rate that's unsustainable so that we can get the government to exist in a way that will not threaten our future, will not burden our kids.
Well,
now,
and it's not
Congress
just
has refused to do that.
And it's not just burdening our kids. It's right now, it's probably our great-great-grandchildren. Because that debt,
well,
we talk about trillions of dollars, but, you know, it's not $18 trillion. It's more like $21 trillion plus another $100 trillion floating around there. So
it is absolutely unsustainable. I mean, the average child born today is socked with $60,000 into the national debt as his share or her share. And that, as you point out, is the tip of the iceberg, because we have unfunded entitlement programs that have a present value, according to Lawrence Kotlikoff of Boston University, of $210 trillion. And that means literally every child born today is born with over $1 million in liability for unfunded entitlement programs that they never had a chance to vote on. And see, this is the thing. as long as the federal government has an unlimited credit card, has the unlimited capacity to borrow, it will use that power, and it will use that power till the system crashes and until they burden our kids with so much debt that their future is extinguished. It basically guarantees taxation without representation, which is what led to our country being founded in the first place. So we have to stop that insanity, and Congress won't do it. They've never done it. Congress, since the original Bill of Rights, has not tied its own hands using the amendment process. That's why we have to rely on the states. The states have to lead on this simply because Congress is conflicted. It has a conflict of interest. It enjoys borrowing the money and spending it without limit because it allows them to buy votes. It's that simple. So the states that are distant from that whole dynamic, or at least more distant from that dynamic, need to lead, and North Carolina is well positioned to do that.
Well, and so what is it, the process within our state? This bill got introduced, it went to the Judiciary Committee, now it's to the Appropriations Committee. So what is that process, and what are we expecting our legislators to do, and what do we do as citizens and business owners to get out there and make sure this process takes place?
38 states have to join the Compact for a Balanced Budget. They do that by passing the very bill that you see in North Carolina. So far, 4 states have already passed that bill: Alaska, Georgia, North Carolina, and Mississippi. Missouri's state Senate just passed it to the House on Monday with a bipartisan vote of 27-6. We've got the bill pending in Texas, in Alabama. It's still pending in Florida. We're basically in a point where we could have 8 to 10 states joining this agreement to advance a federal balanced budget amendment, which would put us within 28 states of getting the job done. So, you know, the basic idea here is to leverage the power that states have to originate constitutional amendments under Article 5 of the U.S. Constitution, but to do it in a way that is fully fleshed out in advance with a formal contract, a compact between the states, so you know exactly what you're going to get from this convention process. In this bill, the one that is pending in North Carolina, HB 366, is everything that is involved in the amendment process. You can read the amendment itself. It's in the bill. You can see the convention rules. You can see who's going to the convention. You can see that the states are committing to ratifying the amendment if the convention approves it. So the nice thing about the compact approach, where you're having the states agree in advance to advancing this particular federal balanced budget amendment, is that there are no mysteries that unfold, and we can consolidate all of the moving parts in just one bill, and you can get it done in as little as 1 year. Now, that means we have to get another 34 states, including North Carolina, on board. We've got to get Congress to pass the resolution that activates this compact. That resolution is pending with 16 co-sponsors in the House from 13 states. And if that resolution is passed and it only requires simple majorities and no presidential signature, then it entirely becomes a battle in the states. And right now, because of the election results last November, there is a pathway through at least 40 states to getting this done.
Well, and when we're talking about the language of the balanced budget amendment, kind of give us at least the highlights of what it means to have a balanced budget and what it does for us.
Well, the basic idea is you limit spending to cash on hand, with only an exception for a specific line of credit that you can borrow from in bad times. So the question is, how do you create that incentive? So what our amendment does is it literally says just that the federal government can only spend cash on hand from taxes at all points in time, with the exception of borrowing under a fixed line of credit, a specific amount of borrowing capacity. It sets that initial borrowing capacity at the amount of outstanding debt plus 5% on ratification. That extra 5% is a cushion to allow for a transition period to balanced budgets, because we're not going to, you know, just like a heroin addict can't quit overnight, we're not going to screech to a halt in this borrowing right at, you know, the point of ratification. We need a transition period, but at some point it will end because the fixed debt limit will kick in, and as the economy grows, that fixed debt limit will become smaller relative to the size of the economy over time, and so as the economy grows, we will inevitably move closer and closer to a true balanced budget amendment.
So one of the underpinning concepts of this is that with a balanced budget amendment, the economy becomes stronger, the free market system starts working more efficiently. So kind of expand on that.
Absolutely. Well, we know from public policy research that when government borrows, they take resources away from the private sector. And there's only so many resources at a given point in time. And if you borrow, you're taking some away from the private sector. And the government is so much less efficient than the private sector that that means we're not growing as fast. We're not producing jobs as fast. So we know that we want to curtail government borrowing so we can leave more of those resources in the private sector, creating more jobs and more wealth. Also, we know that when states have strong balanced budget requirements, have strong limits on their borrowing capacity, the interest rates that are charged when they do borrow are much less than if they don't. And so you can save money on interest costs to the extent that you do need to borrow if you have a limit on how much you can borrow that's constitutionally fixed. We see that in the states. So we want to have both of those benefits brought to the federal government with a balanced budget amendment. We want to restrict how much the federal government borrows because that means the private sector can borrow more. And that means there's more jobs and more wealth. And we also want to have the benefits of our creditors knowing that we're not insane anymore, that we are going to be capable of paying down our debt because we're not going to borrow to infinity and beyond. And thereby, they will charge less in interest. And in charging us less in interest, then the amount of interest that squeezes out things like national defense will be less over time.
Well, and it also, in a balanced budget amendment, puts more of the control back in the state's hands. This isn't federal government doing what federal government wants. It's again saying the states have rights. We have the right to be different in each state. We get the right to have expectations of what government will and will not do for us, correct?
Well, what's great about our amendment as we've designed it is the only flexibility, the only exception in the limit on the debt the Congress can borrow is if they can convince a majority of state legislatures within 60 days to increase that limit. And so we put the states in a position of control over federal debt policy. We put the states in a position of a board of directors overseeing a wayward CEO. And that inherently, when you got the federal government borrowing as much as it is borrowing, will force the federal government to respect the states more because the states will hold, as long as they're borrowing at these insane levels, essentially control over the power of the purse at the federal level. And so if our amendment were in place, we would finally see a true partnership in government between the states and the federal government, and the states would not be the junior partner.
Well, because historically, and back in the old times, the senators were elected by the legislature in each state, and that kept connectivity. And then we went to the citizenry electing both congressional representatives and the Senate. So that's sort of what this is also restoring, right? That balance of power, that the federal government works for the states, not the states working for the federal government.
Absolutely. And as Ronald Reagan said, the federal government was created by the states, not the other way around. But what the 17th Amendment did is some good and some bad. Now, the good that the 17th Amendment did by having us elect our U.S. senators is it makes corruption in that election process a lot less likely. If you think about it, it's a lot easier to corrupt a state legislature just because it's got a fewer number of people and you know, consider the people who are generally in politics, right? So there was a legitimate criticism of the original design that having state legislatures elect U.S. senators or appoint U.S. senators was more susceptible to corruption than having a popular election of millions of people. But what we lost with the 17th Amendment was external discipline on Washington. We lost states having control over more than half of the federal policy-making power. I mean, think about it. When the states controlled the U.S. Senate, they controlled half of everything in legislation, regulation, taxes, spending, and they controlled ratification of treaties, and they controlled the appointment of federal officials, including Supreme Court justices. Is it any wonder that when the states lost that position of control, suddenly state sovereignty and the 10th Amendment meant nothing to the federal government anymore? And so, you know, we did gain a degree of protection against corruption by having popular elections with our U.S. senators, but we lost a huge measure of this external discipline of the states having control over half of the federal power or more. And so what our amendment is trying to do is restore some of that external discipline and target it to a clear problem area, the borrowing proclivities of the federal government, this insane $18-plus trillion debt that is leading to $200-plus trillion in unfunded liabilities. I mean, we are saying, look, you know, perhaps it's not a bad idea to vote for U.S. senators, but we do need the external discipline of state involvement in national policy, because somebody has to be looking over the shoulders of people in Congress who are not in Washington.
Well, and we're looking at the world dynamic now of the markets, the dollar, and there's a trend towards countries coming off the dollar as the economic standard of trade. There are countries wanting to get their gold back, and here we are as the United States knowing we're borrowing all this money. The value of the dollar comes from it being the trading unit of currency. When that goes away, doesn't that put us in a more dangerous...
It's even more precarious. Forgive me for interrupting,
That's
but
okay.
It got me excited. But it's more precarious than that. The only reason why the dollar is so strong and so reliable is that we're the least crazy country when it comes to fiscal policy. In other words, as bad as we are, things everywhere else appear, at least to our creditors, to be a heck of a lot worse. But the reason why that's so precarious is it doesn't take a whole lot for a country like China to do the right fiscal policy, to change its pathway, for to become, you know, the leader of a legitimately strong currency, and thereby instantly evaporate any advantage that we have in being the least insane country in the world, right? So you know, our status as a reserve currency is an anomaly that is entirely in the control of people who might even be considered, in countries we might even be considered as our political adversaries. And all they need to do to destroy our status as a reserve currency is just do the right thing by their own people and have a better fiscal policy, a better monetary policy. And so think about, you know, if you've got political adversaries like China that could easily be military adversaries, I mean, all they have to do is make the right political choices and they can blow us out of the water fiscally and financially. That's a really precarious place to be in.
And so we're sitting here and we're saying, we've got to get our financial house in order. It's been how many years since we've actually had a budget, ratified budget, from Congress at all?
1997 is the last attempt at a genuine budget, not a balanced budget, just a budget that was agreed upon by both houses and actually laid out what they were going to spend and what they were going to tax for a year. So it's almost been 20 years. And the reason why this is significant is, if you think about it, you know, if you don't have any limit on how much you can borrow, why even have a budget, right? I mean, if you had an unlimited credit card you never had to pay back, would you budget? I mean, for why? I mean, it would be like a ritual that had no meaning. And some, you know, it's the problem is, you know, people who demand a balanced budget or even a budget without limiting how much the federal government can borrow will never succeed, because government will never have a reason to budget until they have a sense that they have limited resources and can't borrow whatever they want. So you know, our point here is, by advancing the Compact for a Balanced Budget, you're advancing a federal balanced budget amendment that will limit how much the federal government can borrow in a very real way. It's going to give the federal government a lot of initial borrowing capacity, no doubt about it, but it's going to be limited. Congress will not be able to unilaterally increase it. And for the first time ever, Congress will know it can't just kick the can, and it will have to create budgets, because otherwise, how is it going to know how to prioritize and how to plan? And so from there, you will get to balanced budget. Because once you start with a budget, then you'll realize that you need to conserve your borrowing capacity, save what borrowing capacity you have for the bad times that are inevitable, which will then incentivize Congress to maintain a balanced budget at all normal points in time.
Well, and it's kind of an interesting thing, because I do a lot of government contract compliance and stuff and work with clients. And there are programs that are set aside, and it says, well, 2.5% of the budget for this type of research will be set aside for small businesses. If you don't have a budget, how do you know that actual 2.5% is that's supposed to be there for small businesses to be doing innovations with is really there? Because,
oh my God, you don't see that. This is the thing: the fraud, waste, and abuse that is possible in a system of unlimited borrowing capacity is beyond our imagination. Because what budgets that do exist have no underlying need or reality behind them, because everyone knows in creating the budget that they can just borrow whatever it takes to get to the next budget. So the numbers at the beginning are never going to be real, because they don't have to be. Everyone knows that if they run out of money, they just can borrow more. So the ability to even measure what government is going to spend or what it has spent or what it plans to spend, all of that becomes meaningless in a world of unlimited resources. And so the opportunity for, you know, waste, fraud, and abuse across the board is mind-boggling.
Well, and there's also no incentive to look to see if, let's say, Health and Human Services has an education or a research program that could be done with the Department of Education. And because they're not aware of that and how the spending is in the budget process, they duplicate those efforts, and less gets done with more money than if there was one well-funded program that was well-managed and could reach out and do innovation projects that could do all of these different things.
You're absolutely right, but it's worse than that. Think about this. If you as an agency know that there's an unlimited line of credit that you can draw on later in the next session when you beg for more money, then it's actually to your interest to spend as much as you got, to waste as much as you got, to not fix the problem, because you will keep as many people on the payroll as you have and even grow your power and grow your employment by asking for more money that you know will be there because you'll just borrow it next year. So the worst thing about unlimited borrowing capacity is it actually encourages the phenomena we see in federal agencies and in a lot of state governments that have, you know, weak limits on their borrowing capacity. But this phenomena where agencies spend every dime of their budget to no good end, because if they fail to do so, they think they won't get as much next year. And so they know that they have to spend it all, whether it's well spent or not. And then they also know that they can ask for more next year because the borrowing capacity is unlimited and there's no good reason they can't get more. They just have to scream louder.
Well, and, you know, I'm out and about meeting with different people, and the thing that is stunning to me is that when I meet workers and they may be engaged in a program and they're supposed to be providing support services, and I met with somebody out in New Mexico and he was explaining to me, I work for the government on this project. I said, what do you do? He says, I play computer games. And I'm like, what do you mean you can play computer games? He said, well, we've been in place for a year, but the actual stuff that we're supposed to be supporting hasn't started yet, but they don't want to move us off or not have our response center. So we just, you know, basically sit and read books and play computer games all day until the rest of the process comes online. And so you're sitting there, in his case, that's 128 people plus their supervisors, all that stuff, billing hours to contribute nothing to our process.
And why not? I mean, money's free, right? They just borrow more next year.
Was free.
Well, I mean, it's not, to the mindset, yes, of somebody who doesn't think beyond, you know, the point of unsustainability, right? To the mindset of somebody who has an unlimited credit card who thinks they can get away with borrowing forever, it looks like free money. And but the root cause of all of this behavior is this false sense of unlimited resources that unlimited borrowing capacity creates. The belief in agencies that they have to spend every dime they have because they're just going to get more next year, that belief is rooted in the federal government constantly borrowing whatever it wants, as much as it wants, year in, year out.
But
so if you limit the federal government's borrowing capacity, you will fundamentally change the mentality of everyone in federal government. You will force prioritization. You will force budgeting. You will no longer see video game playing on our dime.
Well, and it's even, I think it's a more fundamental thing. It's that even with a balanced a budget, if we had a budget, not even a balanced budget, if we had a budget in there and people had to report and create financial statements, our government doesn't even produce financial statements for its agencies. So there's no audit of that. Did it go where it's supposed to? Yes, we have GAO and some of those offices looking at it, but they're looking at a specific program. They're not looking to say, is this entire agency using its $50 million or $50 trillion, whatever their budget is, correctly? Is it doing the programs it's supposed to do? Is it helping the people it's supposed to help? You know, if we look at nonprofit organizations and we look at donations, we're always monitoring how much goes to administration and help, how much goes to actually the programs and the serving of the constituency that they're supposed to be serving. If we looked at that with our government, no one would ever donate if it was a nonprofit, because it's more like 96% goes to the administration and 4% goes to the people it's supposed to be serving.
And you're right, but again, the root cause of the failure to budget is there's no reason to budget. I mean, why budget if, in your mind, you have an unlimited capacity to borrow?
Yeah, there's no.
I mean, if you can, if, I mean, you know as well as I do to craft to craft a good budget, it takes effort, right? You have to put a green eye shade on. You got to pinch pennies. You got to really work hard at it to make a good, meaningful budget. So how do you sustain that kind of motivation when, in the back of your mind, you're thinking as a bureaucrat, well, gosh, we can just borrow whatever we need.
Well, and it's, I think we've even, I mean, I've been in corporations, and I won't name it, but I was in this large corporation, and the first, the original budget they did was right after World War II. And I'm sitting there in the 90s, and we decided to zero base a budget, start from scratch and roll everything up and see where we were. And up till that point, they had just been essentially doing a variance system. They varied every year. They varied off the previous year's budget and reported how much they varied off the variance off the previous year's budget. And that's essentially what our government is doing. We're dealing in the variances, and nobody cares about the complete number. And no one cares about that the programs that are supposed to be there as safety nets will go away when everything falls apart. The programs
that, and even worse, there's no profit motive. There's no competition internally. There's nothing. I mean, as bad as the corporate world can get, and it can get bad, everybody in the corporate world knows that they can go out of business. The federal government, however, has the belief that it can just keep on going with the borrowing and the taxing and never go out of business. And that's the scary thing, because that belief will take us so far along up to and beyond the precipice that we cannot recover. And that's why you have to have a balanced budget amendment in place. You've got to create a structural reform that forces people to think responsibly now before it's too late. And that's why we've got the urgency of moving this compact bill and supporting it in North Carolina. Is we have to get this job fixed. We've got to get it done in the next 5 to 10 years. It will just be too late if we wait longer than that. We will have only one outcome, and that is default through inflation or outright default, one way or the other, just like we see in the third world, and that will be a disaster. I mean, if you look at Argentina, they defaulted about 15 years ago. Their economy still hasn't recovered. They seized everyone's equivalent of a 401k within a couple of years, replaced it with worthless government bonds. I mean, the pandemonium and the calamities that would result from a default on our federal debt, which is going to be inevitable if we don't fix this problem in 5 to 10 years, is going to be so vast that I fear that, you know, it's not just a matter of our prosperity, that it could even be a matter of our civilization survival.
Well, yeah, because you mentioned it earlier, what's happening in Baltimore is just a little microcosm of if heaven forbid the stock market crashes, if the banks have issues, if the government fails, our banking system fails, because that's what props up the banking system. Everything is a set of dominoes, and once that one domino trips, the inflation rates, the prices, the devaluation of the dollar, that's just a compounding effect. And when you're sitting there and you have nothing of value in your hand, I think there were countries in Europe that they used to have to let the workers go several times a day and pay them so they could buy food, because if they waited till the end of the day, the money that they had earned would not buy the food they needed for that day. And that's what we could be facing with rampant inflation. If we throw in our energy needs and transacting, if we're not on the dollar as a currency, there's just so many things that ripple effect there that this is the foundation. If we can get a balanced budget, we get our government back on track. They start answering to us. We get a controlled and reasonable tax policy that, you know, enough revenue comes in and we can say, okay, this is what comes in and this is what we have to spend. My question is, if today this passed, and let's say we got all 38 states, Congress does what it's supposed to do, what would that budget be plus 5% if we looked at it now?
Let's say it passed when we had $20 trillion in outstanding debt, and at current rates, that's going to happen in about a year and a half, right? That means the initial debt limit would be fixed at plus 5%. So it would be a $21 trillion debt limit. Now, the way to think about that is it would be a revolving line of credit of $21 trillion, no more, no less. And the federal government would not be able to borrow any more than that without approval from a majority of state legislatures in a referendum within 60 days, which is a very hard thing to accomplish unless you've got an overriding national emergency, because state legislatures take their sweet time, even on things like Medicaid expansion, which, you know, even though they ultimately did get a majority of states to sign on to that, it took them 5 months, not 60 days, because of the battles that went on at the state level. So the reality is, for all but true national emergencies, with a wide national consensus behind it, the federal government is going to be limited to this initial $21 trillion line of credit. And that means that the federal government would not be able to spend anything it wanted. It would have to limit its spending. It would have to husband its resources. It would have to pay down the debt whenever it could so that it could create a little bit more borrowing capacity for bad times or for cash flow volatility. And so what I would anticipate is within a period of 1 to 5 years, we would transition to a balanced budget, paying down as much of the debt as we possibly can to create some borrowing space for national emergencies or wars. And we would have an entirely different framework of thinking about how to maintain our federal budget. We'd have one that is more responsible, that is driven by priorities, which is driven by a sense of scarcity and resources, which is how normal people and businesses operate. We'd have less fraud, waste, and abuse. We'd have less of a crowding out effect in the borrowing markets with more private investment, more private borrowing, more growth, more jobs. I think within 10 years, we'd turn this country around.
So one question that comes to mind when we think about this is the checkbook's been open for so many things, and we're talking about $21 trillion in borrowing, but we will frequently spend that much on foreign aid and stuff. So is that in that number? Does this also pull us back into spending reasonable amounts? So, you know, not sending foreign aid to countries who are sponsoring terror, those types of things. Will that kind of control come in with this balanced budget amendment, or is that... that's something else the states would have to take on in another amendment?
Well, it wouldn't be, we wouldn't get that prescriptive. What we're doing is we're just limiting how much the federal government can borrow. And so we're forcing hard choices by Congress. They know they can't kick the can anymore without limit. They know they can only borrow so much. So now they're going to have to take a good hard look at what really should the federal government be spending money on. And, you know, if you look at the big three, military, Social Security, and Medicare, right?
Right.
If you limit the borrowing capacity, they're going to have to, you know, over time reduce the amount of spending by 10 to 20%. If the economy grows more, it'd be less. If it grows less, it'd be more. But you'd have to reduce spending by 10 to 20%. And you know that politically they're not going to shave a lot off of military. They're not going to shave off a lot on the Social Security side. They're not going to shave off a lot on the Medicare side. They're just too politically difficult to shave. Where they're going to shave, I think, are in areas where there is no natural constituency, things like foreign aid, things that are duplicative of what goes on in the states. I mean, why have an education department? Why have an energy department? Why have so what you're going to do is you're going to force politically a discussion about priorities, which will put in the hot seat programs like foreign aid, because those programs are going to be a lot easier politically to cut than anything in the military, anything in Social Security, anything in Medicare. So our goal is not to say do this, do that. Our goal is to create the structure that incentivizes prioritizing, and we believe that the prioritizations that are likely to result will pretty much slim down the federal government to, unfortunately, from some perspectives, you know, military, Social Security, and Medicare, but it will pretty much preserve those areas of spending and reduce much of everything else that the federal government does.
But then that will also free up resources to flow in a growing economy in each state, and each state then gets to set its own education policy, its energy policies, and it's based on the citizenry of each state. We get to move. Thankfully, we have freedom of movement. If we want to, don't like this state, we can move somewhere else. We move for our jobs. We do all kinds of things like that. But then again, it gives states more control of their local economies, of their choices on energy policy, and will they drill, or will they have, you know, all of these different things. So we actually get more control by pushing more of these departments back to the state level, rather than saying we're going to let the federal government tell us how we educate our children or how we generate our energy and those kind of things, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. But the benefit of having a limited borrowing capacity and stopping the Congress from kicking the can and spending whatever they think they can spend is that you take that debate out of pure ideology. You know, you and I, in a vacuum, would agree that the states should be handling most of those tasks because that's what the founders intended. The problem is, 70% of America doesn't, really believe that, and we can't really persuade them on a constitutionalist perspective in the time that we need to save our republic. But if you frame it in terms of priorities, right, you don't have all the money in the universe. You do have to prioritize. Where are you going to prioritize your federal spending? Are you going to have the federal government spend money in the areas where it does the best work, things that are truly national, things that are truly international? Or you have the federal government spend money on things that they don't do the best, that states and local governments do the best, which are, local and state matters. Even to a non-constitutionalist, even to a person who's not particularly ideological, suddenly that choice becomes clearer, right? It becomes easier to see that efficiency, avoiding waste and fraud and abuse, these basic good government principles that we all share justify sending those programs to the states and getting the federal government out of them and focusing the federal government on things that are truly national and truly international. That whole debate becomes something we can win, not just with ideology, but with just basic appeal to good government.
So what are the steps? So we know the bill has come out of judiciary here and it's in appropriations. So what are the next steps to move that a bill through appropriation committee here? And then where do we need to get it to go?
Well, what we needed to do is pass appropriations, and that's a large committee in the dozens of members. So anything that folks can do to reach out to their House members in North Carolina to support HB 366 would be helpful. And beyond that, we have to, succeed on the floor in the House. But the great thing is, we're going to be persuading hopefully so many members in the House Appropriations Committee that will be most of the folks on the floor that we'll need to persuade as well. So I would say that the most impact that somebody could have would be to reach out to members of the House and see if they have time to learn about the compact, HB 366, send them to our website, www.compactforamerica.org, www.compactforamerica.org. Encourage them to visit, to participate in the seminar that I'm going to be presenting in Pinehurst this Sunday at 2 o'clock with the More Tea Citizens Group in Pinehurst Community Center at 2 o'clock this Sunday, May 3rd. I'm going to be, for an hour and a half, doing a full seminar on the Compact for a Balanced Budget. So I encourage the members as well as other citizens to attend that to get educated. I think that if folks learn about the Compact and the policy that we're trying to accomplish, they will only get excited about it, and they will realize that this is not a pipe dream. This is something that we can accomplish. We can get it done in 3 to 5 years. We can save the country. We can create prosperity through just basic good governance principles that would be required if this amendment were in place. We can reinvigorate states in an equal partnership with the federal government. We can introduce our state legislatures to the idea that they have an important role in checking and balancing Washington. I mean, all of these good things will follow when we use this bill, this Compact for Balanced Budget, as sort of the vehicle to introduce our citizens, our friends, our colleagues, and the members of our legislatures to these ideas. And, frankly, Compact for America exists for more than just one compact. I mean, we are hoping that we'll prove the concept of using these interstate agreements, these contracts, to get amendments done, that will prove this concept first with the balanced budget amendment, something that most people of any ideology can agree upon, and then move on to other areas where we can have similar success in preserving and protecting our republic, things such as term limits, not only for elected officials, but for bureaucrats. I mean, I don't think we want to limit, the terms of people we elect in favor of those we don't elect. We want to limit everybody's terms in government, probably with an emphasis on the civil servants in government. In addition to that, we'd probably look at bank bailout bans. I mean, we should never be in a position where something like the TARP, that $700+ billion slush fund that was handed off to Wall Street, can happen again. Most states ban subsidies to private businesses in their state constitutions. I mean, an overwhelming supermajority do. So there's a good reason to believe that a similar amendment would get the support of 38 states at the federal level. So there's a lot of great concepts that have been tried and adopted by supermajorities of states in their state constitutions that we can export to the federal government and its constitution to restrain it and to restore the republic through the vehicle of agreements like the Compact for a Balanced Budget. That's our ultimate vision at Compact for America.
So at what point do you start looking at navigating through the waters again with these other And the banking one comes to mind right now because, you know, there's a lot of conversation out there that says the next bailout of the banks will not come from the government, but will come from the investors, the account holders of those banks, because the government will not have the facility to bail out the banks again. So are you going to wait till you've spearheaded the balanced budget amendment clear through the process, or are you going to kick off one of these others as you get more and more of the states in line on this one?
It's a function of resources and on-the-ground realities. If we had $20 million, we'd be looking seriously at issues like that right now. We've only been able to raise about $1 million, just short of $1 million, over the past 6-7 months. For a campaign like this Compact for Balanced Budget, we need to raise around $15 million to be successful. Now, that may sound like a lot of money, but the average ballot measure in just the state of California is running about $20 million each and every election cycle. So think about that efficiency. If you can raise, you know, less than the typical California ballot measure, you can have a really plausible shot at something like a federal balanced budget amendment or a ban on bank bailouts or term limits for civil servants. Or, you know, so the point of the matter is, we have developed a legislative technology, the agreement called a compact for a balanced budget or any other constitutional amendment, that is so efficient and consolidates so many moving parts that it's plausible to actually reform the federal constitution with less in resources than just fixing or doing some sort of legislative ballot measure in California.
So if someone wants to get involved with this on a, you know, as a donor, those kind of things, what's the website and what's that process? What type of nonprofit are you? 501c?
We are a 501c3 at Compact for America Educational Foundation and a 501c4 at Compact for America Action. But one of the unique factors that allows us to engage in so much legislative advocacy on the educational side is that we were actually hired and working under a technical services agreement with the Compact for a Balanced Budget Commission. We are actually wearing the hat of a public official as the Compact Administrator for the existing Compact for a Balanced Budget at the direction of the first interstate agency ever created that has the job of advancing and proposing a constitutional amendment, of actually marshaling the states and checking and balancing the federal government. You can visit their website at balancedbudgetcompact.org. But the, you know, the advantage of having this relationship with the Compact for a Balanced Budget Commission is it allows us to qualify for an exemption on most of the limitations on lobbying that a C3 would otherwise face, and that enables us to accept tax-deductible donations for quite a bit of legislative advocacy. And so I would encourage folks to visit www.compactforamerica.org, www.compactforamerica.org, to make donations to the Educational Foundation. And then if you want to support a more political activity, the action side, the C4, has the ability to play to a certain extent in electoral politics. And if people have an interest in donating there, they can visit Compact for America -action.org, compactforamerica-action.org.
So one more question, and it's around the commission. Who created the commission, and how was that process undertaken?
Well, the great thing about the compact is as soon as two states joined it, it empowered those two states to appoint the first two members of a commission to then marshal, oversee, and advance the overall effort. And so when Alaska and Georgia joined the compact last year, they formed the Compact Commission. And in January, the Compact Commission retained the Educational Foundation to serve as the Compact Administrator and to provide it with technical advice and assistance in propagating and overseeing the Compact for a Balanced Budget in other states. And since then, we've brought on two more states, Mississippi and North Dakota, and we're expecting another 3 to 4 states this session. Mississippi will appoint a commissioner to the commission soon, and that's it. There's only going to be 3 initial commissioners in the commission to keep it able to move fast and make quick decisions and to really lead. But the advantage that we have with this commission behind us is not just, you know, an IRS code function. The great thing about the commission is for the first time ever, you have a durable representation of the states that are involved in this process. So unlike past efforts to advance an amendment from the states, such as the Reagan and Milton Friedman effort of the 1980s, which dissipated over time, this has an actual institutional body to confront and to organize and to deal with Congress and whoever else it may need to deal with to get the job done.
So are those legislative appointments in each state, or does the governor appoint, or how do those three representatives get on the commission get appointed?
The default setting is a governor appointment, but every state that could appoint someone can modify that provision to allow for some other process. So far, nobody has. In all the cases that we anticipate a commissioner being appointed, it will be by the governor.
And so does this end up being a bipartisan compilation, or is it leaning one side or the other politically?
Well, so far it's been Republican governors appointing, although in Alaska, the appointment was maintained by the incoming independent governor. So I think we could call it bipartisan. The goal of the Compact for a Balanced Budget is to be bipartisan. I'm proud to say that we've had Democrat votes in every state where we've succeeded so far. Most recently in Missouri State Senate, we did peel off two of the nine Democrat votes in the Senate, which, although is a minority, it's not an insignificant number relative to the number of Democrats in the Senate. And in fact, in Texas, one of our co-sponsors is the former legislative director of former U.S. Senator Paul Simon, who in the 1990s was regarded as the most liberal person in the U.S. Senate, but yet ironically supported a balanced budget amendment because he recognized, and this is his term, that intergenerational injustice will result if we don't have a limit on the federal government's borrowing capacity, because what we're doing is we're borrowing from our kids and sending them the bill for our spending. And so the interesting thing about a balanced budget amendment, and this is why we've led with a balanced budget amendment, is you can find cross-partisan, bipartisan support, because it's a basic good government practice. I mean, to not send the bill to our kids, to not tax people without representation, to not spend the money we don't have, to live within a reasonable limit of our means. So there was a time, and we hope to revive that time. But there was a time when this was no-brainer stuff. That's why 44 state constitutions have limits on debt or balanced budget requirements. It's not all red. There's a lot of purple and a lot of blue. So, our hope at Compact for America and for the Compact for Balanced Budget Commission is to bring on bipartisan support for this particular idea. Now, in the future, we may have compacts that are more ideologically skewed one way or the other, and they may not be compacts that I personally agree with. Our job at the Educational Foundation is to provide expert technical support in a nonpartisan way. We'll draw the line at certain compact concepts, but others we will probably support even if we don't agree with it. The point is, the ability to organize the states in a formal contract to get the amendment process done with a known amendment in advance, the process known in advance, and everything streamlined and consolidated into one bill you pass one time in each state is such a powerful idea that we want that idea to propagate because of the significant shift in power the idea in and of itself entails away from Washington and towards the states and towards the American people. That shift of power away from Washington in and of itself, for whatever specific purpose it may have, will help save the republic, because it's the consolidation of power and the abuse of consolidated power that leads to the downfall of every republic in history.
So your team there in both of those organizations is a combination, we've talked about this before, of political beliefs, backgrounds, and those kind of things. So kind of explain that too to the audience, because I think a lot of times when people think balanced budgets and Civitas groups and those kind of things, that this is strictly a Republican initiative. But you have a real mixed bag of talent there providing this technical advice and working on this.
Yeah, I mean, our two organizations, the C3, the Educational Foundation, and the C4, the Action Organization, have a wide spectrum of folks involved in the advisory and scholarship councils. The advisory council on the C4 side, our action side, or potentially political side, includes progressive Harvard Law professor Lawrence Lessig. Now, he's not a huge fan of a balanced budget. I mean, I don't think he opposes it. He just, you know, he has other priorities that I don't personally agree with, but he agrees with the concept of a compact. He agrees with the general principle of decentralizing power from Washington. Now, he happens to believe it will advance his agenda more so than the agenda I prefer, but we both agree that it's not good for a republic to consolidate power in a place where it's easily abused. And so he's on our advisory council on the C4 side. On the C3 side, we tend to have more center-right folks for the Educational Foundation. We have well-known person, Dean Clancy, used to be the vice president of FreedomWorks. We have Ilya Shapiro, who's the leading constitutional scholar below Roger Pilon at the Cato Institute. We have Jake Jacobs, who recently joined us, who's written a lot of about political correctness and how it's really a terrible thing. So we have we have progressives, we have moderates, we have conservatives. We tend to create the most ideological diversity on the political action side because that's where you need it the most in order to be successful. On the C3 Educational Foundation side, we tend to keep things more center-right. But in the end, everyone has to acknowledge that when you're using the amendment process, you have to get ratification in 38 states. And that means whatever your personal philosophy, whatever your personal ideology, reality checks and balances what is possible in a reform. You have to pick those reforms that have crossover attraction to folks in the center and in the center left, even if you start on the center right and vice versa. So the nice thing about having an agenda consisting of amending the Constitution, which requires 38 states, is whoever is on your team, whatever their ideology is, the reality constraint of getting to 38 states forces you to find principled solutions that can find common ground across the political spectrum, across the ideological spectrum. And, you know, our society is not yet so corrupt that you can't find impactful areas of cross-partisan support. You know, we've already identified one, that's the balanced budget amendment. But, you know, things like banning subsidies to banks, bank bailouts, that's something with huge crossover support. Even term limits, if you expand it to include, both civil servants and elected officials, you can find cross-partisan support for it. There's other ideas out there that aren't quite as sexy or you haven't heard about, but things like, a single subject rule, something that would end earmarking, that sort of behavior, or log rolling.
Explain that, what log rolling.
Serious cross support. So there's a lot of really impactful ideas that if you want to look for them, if you have the motivation to look for them, you can find them, and that's what we're hoping to do at Compact for America.
Well, it sounds like you were talking about the earmarking and the log rolling and those kind of concepts, but it gets back to the basics of, we don't have to pass bills to see what to find out what's in them. We want to start building our systems and stuff that equally apply, whether the Republicans are in the House, control the House or the Senate, or the Democrats are. The people need to be represented and be able to know what our elected officials are doing, and they're representing us. And that's the goal, really, is to start putting that structure back in as it was intended, so they truly answer to us. There's more participation at the state level and more control so that we know what's going on. It's based on our values, whatever those values, whether we agree with those or not. But when we're at the state level making those choices on our own behalf, it's better than if the federal government's making them for us and then telling all the states to accept it.
Absolutely. And believe it or not, I mean, look, why is a guy like Lawrence Lessig from Harvard Law, a guy with whom I disagree probably 80% of the time on specific policy issues, why is he on the team? Because there are literally dozens of areas where structurally, in terms of what good government requires, we agree, and which are very impactful. Now, he in his own mind probably thinks it will lead to some sort of socialist progressive state, right? In my mind, I see it as leading to free market constitutionalism. Regardless of where we ultimately think these structural principles lead, the fact of the matter is that they do exist and we can agree on them as good government principles. And I frankly think eventually I'll persuade guys like Lawrence Lessig and other honest folks in his ilk to support where ultimately we hope to go, which is more freedom, more limited government, more constitutionalist framework. But in the meantime, look, there's left-right convergence on decentralizing power. There's left-right convergence on reading the bills that are passed. There's left-right convergence on not subsidizing private interests, socializing risk and costs. There's left-right convergence on not, you know, spending and borrowing without limit. There's left-right convergence on, stopping warrantless surveillance. There's left-right convergence on many, many huge structural issues. You don't have to worry about what in their heart of hearts they think will result in the long run from these structural reforms. All you need to do is focus on the fact that these are real, significant structural reforms that will benefit the Republic from just about any vantage point.
Well, Nick, our time's up. If you can leave everyone with, again, where you're going to be this Sunday in Pinehurst and how they can get there.
Yeah, I'm going to be in Pinehurst, the Pinehurst Community Center in North Carolina this Sunday, May 3rd, courtesy of the More T-Citizens group. And the details on the specific address can be found at our Facebook page. It's facebook.com/Compact for America, or if you just go to Facebook and search for Compact for America, you can get to our Facebook page. Just look for our latest event. It's free. I hope to see you there. It's an hour and a half, so we're going to have plenty of time for questions, and it'll be a lot of fun.
Well, thank you again for being on the show, Nick, and we'll see you Sunday.
Looking forward to it. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, I want to remind everyone that next Thursday, May 7th, we will be having a fundraiser to support WCOM-FM and keep all of these wonderful shows on the air. And that will be held at the Hickory Tavern on May 7th from 5 p.m. till 10 p.m., where 10% of the food sales receipts deposited will be donated to WCOM. WCOM is listener-funded, so we hope you will turn out to be at the Hickory Tavern. That's Thursday, May 7th from 5 to 10 p.m. to support WCOM-FM. And till next time, everyone, stay focused on the important things.